And the Lord spake unto Moses, saying, Command the children of Israel that they bring unto thee pure oil olive beaten for the light, to cause the lamps to burn continually in the tabernacle of the congregation. And it shall be a statute forever in your generations.
The Eternal Light. The National Broadcasting Company and its affiliated independent stations present The Eternal Light, a program which comes to you under the auspices of the Jewish Theological Seminary of America. Our program today, The Garments of Truth, is written by Judah Stamper.
To hunt for treasure, you have to cultivate the unexpected. Whether it's flying over a wilderness with a Geiger counter in your lap, listening for the click of radioactive ores, or pounding a steel bit through mile after mile of rock probing for oil, or removing an entire mountain, basket by basket, and sifting it through a sieve to find some useless pieces of broken pottery, perhaps, or once in a blue moon, a window to a departed civilization.
Professor Hopkins! Professor Hopkins!
Who had catch your breath, man? You must have run all the way from the diggings.
Professor Hopkins, sir, you told me to let you know as soon as we found anything.
Yes?
It's a wall, sir, on the other side of the western gate.
A wall, you see?
Yes, sir.
Oh, come at once and have a look. Professor Ostovstev!
Yes?
Fuad says we've struck a wall, and by the western gate, where you predicted.
Excellent, excellent news. Let's go have a look at
us.
These caravan cities, it's exciting digging them. Not like excavating a Canaanite village. You have every culture, every religion, cheek to jowl with one another. Never know what will turn up. By the western gate, you say?
Yes, yes, if Fuad is right now. That would place it, well, within the area the Roman commander filled in against the Persian attack before the city fell.
Yes.
To make that one enormous defensive wall, you know? Ostosted, why, that area is a time capsule, like those left nowadays in the foundations of buildings. The swing of a few pickaxes, a bit of digging, and, well, if we're lucky, we'll pull the lid off and see what was locked inside over 17 centuries ago. Over 17 centuries ago. Over 17 centuries ago.
The year is 245 A.D. The place, Dura Europus. The site will mean nothing in a millennium, but here in the 3rd century we are in a crowded, armed, and restive Roman fortress. The frontier of an empire. The gateway to the Mesopotamian Valley. Endless caravans thread through the crowded markets, carrying the wealth of the East to Rome. Tired Roman legions bivouac on their way to battle. Beggars swarm out of the gates like flies to descend upon the stranger and the unwary. A strange new religion, Christianity, has just taken root here. Its church is decorated with frescoes older than the oldest catacomb paintings. And here, in a stall by a narrow, winding valley, an old scribe carefully dips his quill in ink and copies out a Torah scroll, letter by letter.
Grandfather?
Hmm?
Grandfather, I want to ask you something.
In a moment, David. Let us see if you can learn patience in the time it takes me to finish this verse. El Moshe. L'amor. There. Now, what is it, David?
Grandfather, why do you put so many crowns on top of the letters when you write a Torah scroll? It takes so much more time that way.
David, I'll answer you with a story. They say that God himself is a scribe writing Torah scrolls in heaven.
Is that really true, Grandfather?
Stories are not true or false, David, like weights in a scale. They're rather the garment truth wears to make itself visible. And who knows, perhaps God does busy himself writing Torah scrolls. After all, it's as dignified as creating worlds, and more sensible than chasing rabbits, as you do when you go out to the country.
Does God then put crowns on the Torah letters he writes in heaven?
No. No, God first wrote his Torah letters bare, for crowns were not needed. But when Rabbi Akiva became the wonder among teachers, God said to himself, "Now this Rabbi Akiva needs more occupation." And so he added crowns to all the letters of the Torah, so that Rabbi Akiva could interpret not only the letters of the law, but the very crowns above them.
Such a wise old scribe, patient and learned, trained in the academy of the patriarch Judah the Prince, would be teacher to young and old alike. To him would also come the elders of the community when a fine point of law was at issue, as it was this very day, about the plans for a new synagogue.
Reb Sholem, be like your name a source of peace, or we will never finish the new synagogue. I insist that we decorate the walls with paintings, that the eyes should see and the lips should speak one hymn of praise to God, as it was written, "My heart and flesh shall praise the living God." But Reb Shmuel here...
Why, it's a violation of the Ten Commandments themselves. You'd think we were worshippers of idols the way we cover our synagogue walls with images.
You see how we stand, Reb Sholem. And tomorrow we must come to a decision, or the artist will move on to Nisibis, which the armies have just recaptured. Do I wish to quarrel with Reb Shmuel here? But this is a matter of principle. But tell us. Tell us how we can resolve this.
Reb Shmuel?
Yes, Reb Shmuel.
Reb Shmuel, Rabban Gamliel was a great teacher.
What are you asking? He was a master of the oral tradition, a prince in Israel.
And would you consider him a pious man?
A pious man. His very footsteps were like decisions in law.
When I studied in the court of his grandson, Rabbi Judah the Prince, I heard a story about him. In the baths at Akko, which Rabban Gamliel attended, for he was a fastidious man, there was placed a statue of the pagan goddess Aphrodite. When his students asked him how he could continue bathing there, in the face of the law against images, he said, with a twinkle in his eye, "Your complaint is against the goddess, not against me. After all, she entered into my domain, not I into hers."
But, Reb Sholem, what of the law against graven images?
Reb Shmuel, the law against graven images says, "Thou shalt not bow down to them or serve them." Now I ask you, for shame, is it to this use that our paintings and our synagogue will be put?
Reb Sholem, you have decided it like a man of peace. He who enters our synagogue to pray will enter the very courts of heaven. Come, Reb Shmuel, come. You and I will sign the contract together.
And so the synagogue at Dura Europus was built, not bare and cold, but covered from wall to wall and from floor to ceiling, with paintings on top of paintings, radiant with color. When the interior was finished, at their first service...
Grandfather! Grandfather! Has the whole Bible come to life again? David and Moses, and Elijah and Jacob and Ezekiel.
Mm-hmm.
It is as if the very walls are praying. I'm almost afraid to remain here with them looking down on me from every side.
The fear of people, David, unlike the fear of God, is a sign of ignorance. If you are afraid of them, Make them your companions and friends. Don't turn away from the sources of your strength.
Grandfather. Grandfather, I want to ask you something.
Hush. Our first service is about to begin.
God, O Shem. O Abiti. Meon Beitecha. Unekon Mishkan Kevadecha Vani Eshtachave.
During the building of the Dura Europa Synagogue, Persians and Romans fought almost on their very doorsteps. And as the flashing figures on the synagogue walls brought the service to life, caravans brought congregations of scholars and merchants from the crumbling community in Palestine to new centers in the Mesopotamian Valley. There, schools were opening in every village, and tens of thousands of farmers gathered twice a year for instruction in the great new academies of Babylonia. Going to school then was not like walking to the corner for a bus that would return that same afternoon. It meant tearing boys from their homes to cross frontiers, deserts, and armed camps. And who knew when their families would see them again?
I have taught you all I can here in Dura Europos, David. You must go and study at one of the great academies.
No, Grandfather, I don't want to leave you yet. Let me study with you for one more year, for another winter.
Abandon one day, and 2 days will abandon you. No, the wars are too serious to permit delay. You must go while the roads are still relatively open. There is a merchant on a caravan passing through with whom I studied when I was your age and whom I would trust with my life. You'll travel with him.
Is this the caravan to Galilee and the academy where you studied?
No, this is eastward to Sura, where great new schools are opening, the equal of any in Palestine. Our people are freer there. Be our emissary, David. We may someday have to come to you for safety.
Grandfather? Grandfather, you're dreaming again.
Strange how there suddenly flashed before me the picture from our synagogue walls of Ezekiel bringing the dry bones to life. When will our dry bones come back to life? My father sent me to Dura Europos. I'm sending you to Babylonia. Will your sons grow by your side? Or will you have to send them even farther to lands of which barbarism itself has not yet heard? Send messages with whoever you can, David. Our hearts will inhabit the roads between here and Sura, awaiting news from him.
Don't forget us here in Dura Europa.
Orders of the general!
But we are in the midst of a festival service. Let us finish our prayer.
There must be no delay. This entire row of buildings is to be evacuated. See to it, soldier.
Don't be frightened. Don't be frightened, anyone. Let us leave quietly. We may be back before the festival is over.
You'll never be back here, Rabbi. These Persians are such devilish soldiers. The very walls of this city aren't thick enough to hold out their battering rams. So our commander is filling in the street behind the wall, filling in this row of buildings behind the street to make a wall they'll never batter down.
What are you saying? Our, Our synagogue, only 10 years after it's built. Our beautiful synagogue to be filled in and buried like a cistern or an infected house.
Those are our orders. I don't like them, but I'd like it less to have my throat cut. All right, outside before the engineers get here.
Don't be frightened, my people. Prayer needs no house if we must go in the streets, in the fields, in the wilderness. Let us leave with dignity.
Grandfather!
David, you've come back.
I've come to take you to Sura with me. I have a safe conduct through the Persian lines.
David, can I begin again to sing God's songs in a strange land?
Oh, Grandfather, you haven't seen this Persian army. Dura Europos is doomed. Drunken soldiers will have no pity on your white head.
It is enough if I die that I've lived this long. It will be, and I will be, of no use in a strange place.
Grandfather, do you remember wondering when I left for Sura if my sons would be forced to wander from me too?
How well I remember, David.
And do you remember the painting of Jacob blessing the sons of Joseph on our synagogue walls?
I shall never forget it. It stands right over the niche where the Torah scrolls are kept.
Grandfather, Jacob came to Egypt as an old man and blessed the sons of Joseph. I too now have sons. They inhabit my home. They live in my village. I have raised them proud and free as you raised me. Come and give my sons your blessing.
Blessed is the teacher who learns from his students. Which way must we go?
This way. This way, Grandfather.
If undermine the southern wall, there's no holding the city now!
Professor Hopkins.
Hmm?
Professor Rostovtsev, we've begun to clean the wall we discovered. It's a wall of fresco paintings. There's not a bare inch on it.
Fresco paintings? Well, then it's probably a place of worship of some kind.
Any guesses, Hopkins?
Well, it could be anything. That is anything but a synagogue. Their walls never carry images.
Let's have a closer look.
I can't understand it. The Exodus from Egypt, you see? Yes, and alongside it, there's Moses in the burning bush. Well, there's no iconography in all the literature that even remotely resembles it.
If there are frescoes on the top level, there are probably frescoes all the way down. Let's see what the next level turns up.
This is more incredible all the time.
Yes.
There's Moses giving the law. Yes. And Aaron and his sons being consecrated. Uh-huh. And there, Jacob blessing his sons. And the ark being sent back by the Philistines.
This looks more and more like a synagogue all the time.
There's no precedent for it. No precedent whatsoever. Why, these figures are like those in the Roman catacomb paintings. And from the middle of the 3rd century. Now, this would upset every known theory about the transmission of art from the Romans to the Byzantine in medieval Europe.
By the depth we've dug to, I would guess we have one more tier of paintings to go. Well, let's reserve judgment until we see what the last tier holds.
No more room for doubt. There's Moses being found by Pharaoh's daughter, you see.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And here, David being anointed as king. And now... Yes, here, you see, the niche where the Torah scrolls were kept. We're standing in the synagogue, Rostostev. A 3rd century synagogue whose walls are solid with fresco paintings. Why, the nearest thing to it are some mosaic tile floors from some 5th century synagogue in Palestine. But they're all different in every possible way. There's not another synagogue even remotely like it in all the world.
Hopkins, could this be all that's left of a whole world of Jewish art, obliterated by exile and persecution? If there was one such synagogue, there could have been hundreds. Mm. Brute numbers mean nothing in such matters.
Yes. And could this be the mysterious bridge we've always sought, from classic art to early Byzantine and catacomb paintings?
Yes.
It has the realism of Roman painting, and the religious subject, the symbolic objects, and and the stylized frontal postures of the catacomb figures.
We'll have to get photographic plates of these walls immediately and send a report to the America Oriental Society. Mm-hmm. The entire synagogue will have to be removed and set up where the paintings can be properly cared for.
Say, Elliot, look at this book of paintings from the Dura Europa Synagogue.
Paintings from a synagogue?
Yeah.
No, Harry. Afraid you're mistaken.
Hmm?
I've studied this business a little. You never get paintings from a synagogue. A few mosaics, maybe, but paintings. Uh-uh. Not on your life.
Look, I'm not crazy. See for yourself.
Well, I take it all back. This sure is a new one on me.
It's strange, though. You know, these pictures don't look Jewish. What do you make of them?
You know, you're wrong, Harry. Doesn't matter whether they look Jewish or not. Not really. Here, this is much more significant. What the artist is saying. Aaron and his sons being consecrated as priests in the tabernacle. Look at that.
Hmm.
I tell you, Harry, whoever painted these certainly had flesh and blood. Why, the insecurity of the times must have been just... well, enormous for him to say no, no like this in painting after painting. Look at that body, dragged by the hair out of the valley of dry bones,
yes,
staring you in the eye with a face still half-corpse, as if to say, I know what death is, but it's life I'm gravitating towards. It's not walking or flying, it's gravitating, the way you and I breathe. And here... the Ark, returning to its home from Philistine captivity. This one, the Jews coming out of Egypt from slavery to freedom. And here, Moses pulled alive out of the river where all his brothers had drowned.
Yes.
This one must be Elijah bringing the widow's son to life after he had died. And look at this. Heads and arms and legs coming together and forming live bodies. It's like an atomic explosion in reverse.
Well, so what are you getting at, Elliot? You're telling me that in this picture, the hand of God dragged up a dead body by the hair and didn't just make it live. He made it believe in life while it was still a corpse, which is infinitely harder. But all you've done is to take the image off the paper and put it into words. Now cut the image. What are you driving at?
Harry, do you remember that argument we once had about whether an artist just paints a painting or whether he's one of the characters in his painting or whether he's every character he paints?
Oh, sure. I remember that. Well, I think we agreed then. When a man just paints, he's a hack. He might as well sit down and turn out happy birthday cards so many an hour. And then if he's only one of the characters in his painting, it's adolescent art. He's just shadowboxing with straw men because he hasn't the guts to slug it out with the people he's really after.
Right. But if he's every person in his painting and a craftsman, too, then he can be more magnificent than life. Because in life, he can only be himself, and he's stuck with it. But in art, he could be every person he ever had a chance of becoming. Murderer, Don Juan, saint, suicide, what you will.
Well, all right, but... what does that have to do with these Dura Europa's paintings?
This is art, Harry. Which means that this painter is the corpse, and he's the hand of God also. Remember now, this was painted in the 3rd century on the threshold of exile, when these communities had the life beaten out of them. And then they floated through the air drawn by nothing but the hand of God inside them. Which isn't a bad image for the Shekinah. The indwelling divine presence, come to think of it.
Oh, well, you're an incorrigible romantic. You know as well as I do that the exile was no valley of dry bones. We were farmers, merchant princes, craftsmen, physicians. And where did it lead up to? hate-ridden Polish villages and Nazi gas chambers, and the forced assimilation of the Soviet Union.
And you and me discussing it freely here in America?
No.
Because in life, there's never an end. There's just what happens. But in art, you grab hold of the ultimates implicit in what's happening. And the ultimates this fellow grabbed hold of were corpses and the hand of God. Not bad for third century Syria. Because when the farms get confiscated, the merchant princes arrested at every border, the tools of the craftsmen broken, and they themselves led like corpses into the mouth of death itself, the hand of God would still lead them singing, Ani Mamin, the song of the Messiah. Because the life which they had in their hands wasn't a commodity to them. It was a resurrection and an article of faith.
Whoa, take it easy. You're an unmitigated romantic, Elliot, but you're all right. You know, interpretation aside, these paintings aren't half bad. I'd like to have known some of the people that prayed in that synagogue.
Mm-hmm.
Think about it a minute, Elliot, and you can almost hear the likes of that fellow there talking to us.
Stories are not true or false, like weights in a scale. They are the garment truth wears to make itself visible. Don't be frightened, my people. Prayer needs no house. If we must go in the streets, in the fields, in the wilderness, let us leave with dignity. Blessed is the teacher who learns from his students.
If you would like a copy of today's script, please send your name and address with 10 cents to cover the cost of postage and handling to the Jewish Theological Seminary of America, 3080 Broadway, New York 27, New York. Eternal Light drama today, The Garments of Truth, was written by Judith Stamper. Cantor David Butterman sang the liturgical music. Featured in the cast were Edgar Staley, Nelson Olmsted, Guy Repp, James Stevens, Peter Laser, Billy Redfield, and Larry Robinson. Your narrator was Norman Rose. This is Lionel Rico speaking. Our program is directed by Parker Gibbs. This weekly program is presented under the auspices of the Jewish Theological Seminary of America. This is the NBC Radio Network.